Egyptian satellite images collected on February 29th and compared them with images taken before and after the war broke out. UNISAT said this represents an increase of nearly 20,000 damaged structures compared to its previous assessment, which was based on images taken in January. UNOSAT will continue to closely monitor the situation and collaborate with humanitarian and development partners to provide accurate and timely information for effective response efforts. And in weather today in Washington, D.C., it is 49 degrees and partly cloudy. Temperatures are forecast to drop to the 30s overnight and rise to the mid-50s tomorrow. For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Hey, welcome to the Labor Heritage Power Hour, a weekly radio show celebrating the cultural heritage of the American worker.
We're a proud founding member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, laborradionetwork.org.
I'm Chris Garlock.
And I'm Elise Bryant.
On today's show,
I always knew that I was going to write a play about my day job because I write plays about everything. It's who I am. I thought it was going to be a light comedy about actors who get the same day job. But when I was faced with the reality of what was happening in the workplace, the play wasn't going to be that anymore because there was a way more important story that needed to be told.
By day, Laura Neal helps customers find the best outdoor equipment at REI in New York City. By night, she's a playwright. We talk with Laura about how she helped organize a union at the REI Soho and why she wrote a play about it.
And as part of our Women's History Month programming today, we feature several labor sheroes.
She pushed through incredible barriers as a Black woman in an overwhelmingly male union and was unrelenting in her drive for civil and human rights, and opening the doors to leadership for women and people of color.
For yesterday's special, Women Who Made a Difference edition of Sophie's Parlor, we asked women labor leaders to share their own personal sheroes, women they admire or idealize for their courage, outstanding achievements, or noble qualities. We'll hear from American Federation of Labor, Congress of Industrial Organizations President Liz Schuler, DC Coalition of Labor Union Women Chapter President Chelsea Bland, and Virginia Rodino, Executive Director of the Coalition of Labor Union Women and State Director for the Asian Pacific American Labor Alliance.
And in our final segment, also from yesterday's Sophie's Parlor, a trio of powerful songs by women artists.
I'm gonna lay down somewhere shady. Lord, I sure am hard in the sun.
We'll hear Work Song from Nina Simone, Working Girl Blues from Rose City Kings, and Union Woman by Lynn Marie Smith.
That's all coming up on today's Labor Heritage Power Hour.
And we'll start off with AFL-CIO President Liz Schuler and her personal shero.
Got so terribly far.
My labor shero, gosh, so many to choose from. Of course, Mother Jones, Dolores Huerta, Evie Dubrow, Arlene Holt Baker, Linda Chavez Thompson. But the labor shero I want to lift up is someone from my home union, IBEW, and her name is Robbie Sparks. She's retired now, but she was the business manager of Local 2127 in Atlanta, Georgia for nearly 30 years. And over her 42 years as a union member, she led in so many roles, from shop steward to chief negotiator, all the way to the National AFL-CIO Executive Council. So what makes Robbie Sparks my shero? Well, she pushed through incredible barriers as a Black woman in an overwhelmingly male union and was unrelenting in her drive for civil and human rights and opening the doors to leadership for women and people of color. She has mentored more people than I can count, including me, and did so with a sense of purpose and focus that I draw so much inspiration from. And sheroes show up. Sheroes use their power and influence for others. And Robbie did that, whether it was showing up to march with the giants of the civil rights movement, like Dr. King, to fight poverty, or showing up for manufacturing workers in Lithonia, Georgia, who needed safety and a voice at the plant. Robbie was relentless. And she is fiercely, fiercely dedicated to the fight for civil rights, women's rights, worker rights. But with that fierceness, she also has the most optimistic and positive attitude of anyone I know. So whenever I would feel down or challenged, I could call Robbie and she'd say, "You got this." The women of labor are powerful, and I credit and am grateful to sheroes like Robbie Sparks for opening the door, bringing us up that ladder behind them, and charting a path forward for so many in our movement.
This is Harold Phillips from the Labor Week podcast. I'm proud to be a part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, with more than 200 labor radio shows and podcasts from across the country and around the world. The Labor Radio Podcast Network, where working people speak. Find us at laborradionetwork.org.
I get out there with these four giant boxes of shoes. They're not even shoes at that point. They're like boxes of bricks. And he sees me struggling carrying all these bricks. And he's like, "Guess you've never worn these up a mountain." And I tell him, "Look, it's a lot of shoe. They're heavy. You can break all your toes if you're not careful. But I hope it works out, because at this point, you're contractually obligated to buy something." And he smiles and he's like, "I can handle it."
That's playwright and REI worker Laura Neal reading from her play Foot Wears House. We talked with her last week about how she helped organize a union at REI Soho and why she wrote a play about it. Laura Neal, welcome to the Labor Heritage Power Hour. So good to have you here with us.
Thanks for having me, Chris and Elise. I'm really glad to talk to you both.
Welcome, sister.
Laura, you work at REI, which is the outdoor equipment retailer. Although I have to say, as a longtime member, every time I go there, it seems like they have less outdoor stuff and more clothes. But that's probably a topic for another day, but maybe not. We will see. But you've written a play, Foot Wears House, that explores, and I'm quoting here, "the humor, camaraderie, and pure rage that exists at the intersection of no guaranteed hours and salaried managers who are really excited about selling memberships." And that last bit I noticed is really excited about selling memberships is capitalized. And I want to ask you about that. But we want to start with asking, how did you come to write this play?
So I'm a playwright, and I started working at REI because I needed a day job. I thought that it was going to be a wonderful experience because I had heard that the store was unionized, REI Soho unionized in 2022. And so I thought, oh, this is going to be fabulous. REI is so progressive. They must treat their workers so well. And then I rolled in and found out that that was completely untrue. I was confronted with no guaranteed minimum hours, unsafe working conditions, a ton of union busting and retaliation. Now, you know, I always knew that I was going to write a play about my day job because I write plays about everything. It's who I am. I thought it was going to be a light comedy about actors who get the same day job. But when I was faced with the reality of what was happening in the workplace, the play wasn't going to be that anymore because there was a way more important story that needed to be told. And it's worth mentioning that when I got to REI, The union busting was in full force, but so was the union. I came into a wonderful union community who educated me about Weingarten rights and unfair labor practices and what it means to engage in protected concerted action so that your job is safe. This play owes everything to my coworkers, as do I. And I feel very lucky to be part of the REI Soho Union.
So I know you did a reading of it. Did your coworkers attend?
Yes, my coworkers were in it. We did it together. There are 9 characters in Footwear's House, and 8 of them at the reading were played by my REI Soho co-workers, most of whom are not actors. A couple of them are. I do want to shout out Carlos Angel Barajas and Laura Jedinasty, because they are both fabulous actors with their MFAs, who are, you know, professionals who also work at REI, because, you know, artists need day jobs. And they starred in our reading. But we also had coworkers up there who have never acted a day in their life, but believed enough in this story and telling our story, get up there and put themselves out there. So that was one of the real joys, I think, of the reading, is all of us coming together to do that.
That's wonderful. So were these fictional characters that were composites of the real people, or totally fictional characters, but in the setting of the REI warehouse?
Sure. So the play is fiction, but it is inspired by and based on our very real union drive at REI Soho. So what I like to say when introducing people to the play is that all the questionable shit that managers do in the play is real, and all of the questionable shit that union members do in the play is made up for dramatic effects. And that's actually true. We didn't have enough conflict within our union ranks. I had to make some up so that it would be a good story. It is, very recognizable, the play's story and characters, to anyone who has worked at REI, but it is certainly not a one-to-one. It's not a documentary. It is fictionalized. And I hope that by sharing this fiction with the world, we'll get people interested in really digging in and figuring out what's the reality. Let me learn what's going on here so I can support these unionized workers.
So what are the issues that you explore within the play?
So the play starts at the beginning of a summer in May, and we learn that the characters in the footwear department have just gone through a couple of ordeals at the store. There was a gas leak that they weren't evacuated for. There was a flood they weren't evacuated for. These are real things that happened at REI Soho. Okay, this part not made up. It sounds made up, but it's not. They're understaffed. They're not getting the hours that they need to be getting. And we follow a couple of new folks who join the team as they come in. And as the story progresses over June and July, the understaffing gets way worse. And the friendly employer, as it's known in the play, aka REI in real life, cuts pay. They take back the pay that they had given to everyone else in the country. They take it away from this one unionized store. And that's something that really happened to us on June 1st, 2023. We had signed a side letter with REI, we being the union. This happened before I got to the store. So we had signed a side letter with REI agreeing not to strike for a period of 6 months, with the expectation that we would have a fair contract by the end of those 6 months. It was meant as a motivator. And, you know, we thought they were bargaining in good faith and that that would work out. Well, June 1st rolled around, the 6 months had expired, and they hadn't even been to the bargaining table for weeks. They weren't responding to our request to meet for bargaining. There was just no movement and just so much disrespect from REI's lawyers whenever they did deign to respond to an email. It was with the utmost disrespect. And so we did not extend the side letter. Why would we? All it got us was more bad faith bargaining. And so in the play, the characters do not extend the side letter. They reclaim their right to go on strike. And the rest of the play looks at some of the conflicts and obstacles that come up when you're organizing a strike. It is really, really difficult for working class people to go on strike because you need money and you need your job. And so, you know, this is something that the characters in the play really grapple with. And they're also so understaffed and overworked. There's no time to talk about striking. How do you organize a meaningful, well thought out campaign while you're serving 16 customers at a time? And so that's what the latter half of the play looks at, leading up to, spoiler alert, a strike, a successful strike at the end of the play.
So RWDSU is the union that represents the workers at REI?
Yes. So RWDSU represents our local chapter, our shop, REI Union Soho. Most of the other unionized stores are represented by their local chapters of UFCW.
Okay. So is the union in the play a fictional union, or does it actually...
It's a fictional union. The union is us, right? REI likes to make this division between like, oh, RWDSU is the union and you're just these poor little workers they're trying to control. Like, we are the union. I am the union. And so, you know, I am a proud member of RWDSU. We all are. And, you know, RWDSU has been fabulous in, you know, helping to show us some of the ropes of negotiating. But it's my coworkers who are at the bargaining table, right? It's my coworkers who are making these decisions and bringing everything forward. So we owe a lot to RWDSU for giving us infrastructure and organizational support. Shout out to Maria and Jed and Pete and Chris and all of our supporters at RWDSU. But, you know, REI likes to make this division between like, oh, it's them and then it's you and then it's us. Like, there's three parties. There's no three parties. There's us, the workers who are unionized, and there's REI who is not doing what they should be doing. Let's say it politely since we're on air.
I hear you. Thank you.
And actually, let's bring in Maria DiPasquale, who's been sitting in here. And it's a little bit in the weeds, but that's where we live sometimes. Because it raises an interesting question in my mind. So you're writing a play with some fictional, I mean, it's based on, as you pointed out, real things that have happened and a real company, REI. When you do something like this, and I guess I'll bring Maria in on this, are there legal questions that get raised in this, confluence between art and reality? And I can think of many internet, we're here in DC, many international unions whose lawyers would have a fit, with this sort of thing. So, Maria?
I mean, we have really embraced it. Stuart Applebaum, our president, has actually been on the record, in support of the play. And, I think that it just happened so organically. So many of the workers at REI Soho are artists in different respects, including Laura, of course. I think that we are seeing this play as just another, I think Laura put it as like another tool in the toolbox for fighting for a first contract. And that's how RWDSU is seeing this. And we're very supportive.
Back to you, Laura. You came into this as a playwright, as you say, going to work at REI for a day job. Can you talk a little bit about your thoughts about the role of art now that you are in a union within the movement?
I mean, I think the responsibility of any artist is to bring forward stories that you think the world needs to see, right? Say what you think the world needs to hear. And the fact that I'm in a union makes that possible, right? Because, I fiercely believe in the power of the arts. I've said it before, I'll say it again. And if your basic human needs are not met, it is impossible to create art and bring it forward into the world, right? So the fact that I am part of a union that is protecting my job so that I can have these interviews and still be able to, go back into my shop and have job security because I'm in a union, that is the thing that enabled me to write this play, right? So I think being an artist and being a union worker who has labor protections are intricately intertwined. And I think also in terms of, you know, just what this play does for the labor movement, hopefully it is that one tool in our toolbox. You know, there is so much going on in our movement. There is so much power in it. And this is one aspect of that power, right? This is one aspect of being able to bring together a whole bunch of us as workers, and we bring something forward as we did in the Hudson Park Library on February 24th and share one iteration of our story. I also want to shout out one of my coworkers, Neil Coughlin, who is a fierce union activist who has done so much for this movement. He's a photographer and he is doing a union portrait series. So he is taking portraits of individuals and groups in the union and building this just massive, gorgeous portfolio of what it looks like to be a union. So, you know, that is also something that is going on at REI Soho.
You're listening to Labor Heritage Power Hour on WPFW 89.3 FM, your station for jazz and justice. We'll be back with more of our conversation with Laura Neal in just a moment. Here's DC Coalition of Labor Union Women Chapter President Chelsea Bland with her Shiro.
Hi, I'm Chelsea with Metro DC CLU, and my Women's History Month Labor Shiro is Keturah Johnson. Keturah currently serves as the International Vice President for the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA. She began her career in aviation as a ramp agent at Piedmont Airlines in 2013. After 5 years, she moved to the in-flight department and became a flight attendant, where she felt like she belonged. Keturah is also a combat veteran, and being of service is second nature to her, so she immediately became active in AFA-CWA. As a leader and activist in her union, she was elected the Master Executive Council President of Local 61, and during this time secured a historic 100% vote during contract negotiations to strike if negotiations didn't reach a conclusion soon. After 4 years and the worst crisis the flight attendant industry had ever faced, Piedmont flight attendants ratified a new contract in March 2022. Since then, Keturah hasn't stopped making history. On the first day of Pride Month in 2022, Keturah began her term as AFA-CWA International Vice President, making her the first queer woman of color and combat veteran elected to serve in the role. Keturah is a fierce union activist who demonstrates her belief in worker power each and every day. From picket lines and worker actions, Keturah embodies the strength of community and lifting up the voices of those who are most marginalized among us. Thank you, Keturah, for your commitment to the labor movement and your unwavering belief in worker power. Happy Women's History Month.
Back now to our conversation with playwright and REI worker Laura Neal, whose new play, based on the union organizing campaign at the Soho REI, is Foot Where's House? So you said in the reading you had some folks who, like you, are already artists, but other folks who are not. I'm curious particularly about the effect of being in the play, seeing their struggles and their lives, you know, rendered into art for folks who are not artists. What's that been like?
I mean, people seem to think it was hilarious. The play's funny, by the way. You know, I think that that room, the reading, and the closed reading that we had with just the union in August, because obviously I wanted to, you know, show the thing to my coworkers before I took it public, was just full of laughter and catharsis. Just, yes, this is us. We do have the power. We are going to make it to the end of the play where we strike, where we show that power to the employer. You know, we are in this together. We're a community and we're making it happen. And, you know, the response to the play has been very positive. And also, again, you know, it couldn't have existed without my coworkers. The whole time I was writing this play, obviously I was, you know, doing quote unquote research by going to work, but also, you know, getting feedback from my coworkers saying, hey, you know, what do you want to see? What's important to you that it makes it into this play? And I made a lot of revisions from our closed reading in August to our public reading in February, to try and make sure that the play was reflecting as much of that union spirit, that community spirit as possible.
I should have asked you this by email beforehand. I often do this with authors. I don't know if it's something that playwrights do. Do you have a like a scene or a snippet that you can share with folks?
Sure, sure. Let me grab that. I can do a monologue for you. That's the generally the easiest.
Perfect.
Wise. Okay, so this is a monologue for the character Ellie. And Ellie is talking about a customer experience that she had on the floor. So she's talking to her coworker, Davey. Like this guy, he wants a 15-2E Zamberlin. Well, he wants a 15-4E Zamberlin, but we don't have that because they don't make that, because very few human feet need that width. So after a lot of huffing and pouting, he condescends to accept the 15-2E and the 15-2E Loa and the 15-2E Quest and the 15-2E, whatever it's called, the ugly new one that looks like a rocket ship. And I get out there with these four giant boxes of shoes. They're not even shoes at that point. They're like boxes of bricks. And he sees me struggling carrying all these bricks. And he's like, guess you've never worn these up a mountain. And I tell him, look, it's a lot of shoe. They're heavy. You can break all your toes if you're not careful. But I hope it works out, because at this point, you're contractually obligated to buy something. And he smiles and he's like, I can handle it. And I know he doesn't just mean the weight of the shoe. He means he's not obligated to do anything. Or if he was, he'd just get out of it with his fancy legal team, because this man, he's not a lawyer. He's the type of guy who has lawyers. So he smiles, right? And he takes the first brick out of the box, almost drops it because it's so heavy. But then he hefts it in his hand and pretends it's light. And he takes his shoe off, his loafer or whatever, and goes to put this giant Zamberlin on. And his foot is narrow. It's narrow. It's honestly like scrawny in terms of width. Nothing wrong with having a narrow foot, but this man's foot is not a 15-2E. This loafer he took off is like a 10B. A 10B. So I have him do the fit test so we can feel the whole broken toes scenario in his feet, because I'm a good person and even shitheads deserve to keep all their toes. But get this. He stands on the rock and I ask him if his toes are sliding down, and he says, he's not sliding at all. The shoe feels a little tight. And he says, are you sure you don't have a 15-4E in the back? Because I'm definitely a 4E. And I look at this guy who's going to break all his toes when he climbs Kilimanjaro in 2 days. And I almost laugh, because his foot is swimming in that shoe like he swims in his mansion's Olympic-sized pool. Like, he is actually going to break all of his toes just because he thinks his oligarchic foot deserves a mansion too. And he just decides that his toes will be fine. But I can't laugh, because the thing is, he's right. His toes will be fine, because his guide will give him some beat up women's targies they save for the 10Bs who say they're 15-4Es, because that is a whole category of guy. Like, it's not this guy I hate. I hate that he gets to be right.
Oh my God, Lord, that is so, so good.
I love it.
I've seen this guy at REI, I'm sure.
Thank you.
That is wonderful. What's next for the play? Because I really want to see it. I really have to see it.
I really want to see it too. So I'm working with Cullum Summers. So Cullum was the director of our reading on February 24th at Hudson Park Library. He is the artistic director of the Working Theater. And he and I are working together to figure out what comes next for this play. We're really interested in developing it towards production. We both want to see it on stage. We're having conversations about how to make that happen, how to bring this working class piece forward. So I'm very excited to have Cullum on the team. I'm very grateful to Working Theater for supporting our guerrilla reading, as we've been calling it, at Hudson Park. And stay tuned for what comes next.
Well, Laura O'Neill, congratulations. It sounds wonderful. We can't wait to hear what comes next. And we will definitely let our listeners know. So best of luck with the play. Thanks to you and to Maria both for joining us.
I also want to shout out one more thing, if I may.
Of course, of course.
So REI Soho is part of a national union campaign, REI Union nationally. We have 9 unionized stores right now, with many more on the way. And over the past couple of weeks, we have been collectively unveiling the 10 Essentials, which are this program of platform of what we are looking for in a contract, a fair, livable contract from REI. And this past Thursday, March 7th, a bunch of my coworkers from all 9 unionized stores actually went to REI headquarters in Washington and set up a bargaining table outside headquarters and put out an empty chair for Eric Arts. And they marched up to the door of headquarters and they put a memorandum on the door that said, hey, let's agree to get a contract done by the end of 2024. Enough of this waiting. We're going to get a fair contract by the end of 2024. So if listeners want to learn more about the national campaign, about our struggle, about the 10 essentials, please go to rrei.com. That's O-U-R-R-E-I.com. And you can find information there about the movement. You can sign the pledge to get updates about our union and our fight. And you can also read the platform of the 10 Essentials.
I look forward to this. And I love this. I got started in theater, actually doing feminist theater. But my paid gig was doing workers theater. The concept was that workers would actually perform the plays. Mm-hmm. And the combination of the professional and the workers is just dynamic. And I know that when the audience sees it and they hear their stories, well, you know, validation that happens that doesn't happen any place else.
Their Thank lives. You so much, Elise.
Oh, looking forward to it, Laura. Yay! Thank you, Maria. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Frances Mary Maule was born this day, March 20th, 1945, in New Jersey, to a housewife and electrician. Her working class childhood and that of her 4 siblings was filled with immense pain and even horror. Incredibly, her inner strength and resilience allowed her to survive and build a life, earning a living her entire life as a waitress. After marrying in her 20s, she and her husband discovered she had ovarian cancer as they searched for reasons why she could not become pregnant. This early detection saved her life, and she had a complete hysterectomy to become cancer free. Determined to be a parent, she and her husband sold their wedding rings in order to afford the adoption of a 16-month-old child from a South Korean orphanage, whom they named Virginia. They soon adopted another child from that same country who was 3 years old. A few years later, they were asked by the adoption agency to parent a third child who was going to age out of the orphanage at 11 years old and be put on the streets homeless. After those 3 children were raised and leaving the nest, my mother fostered and then adopted a child with autism who had been rejected by his first adoptive family after they discovered his special needs. Rather than suffering through a perpetuated cycle of childhood abuse, each of my mother's children grew up knowing that through all of our faults and imperfections, we were deeply loved, cherished, and cared for. Unfortunately, the cancer came back and claimed my mother when she was only 54. She would have celebrated her 79th birthday today. I am who I am because of this woman, my mother, my Shiro. Happy birthday, Mom.
Breaking rocks out here on the chain gang. Breaking rocks and serving my time. Breaking rocks out here on the chain gang, cause it done convicted me of crime. Hold it steady right there while I hit it. Well, I reckon that ought to get it. Been working and working, but I still got so terribly far to go. I committed crime, Lord, I need it. Crime of being hungry and poor. I left the grocery store, man, breathing when they caught me robbing a store. Hold it steady right there while I hit it. Well, I reckon that ought to get it. Been working and working, but I still got so terribly far to go. I heard the judge say 5 years on chain gang you gonna go. I heard the judge say 5 years of labor. I heard my old man scream, Lordy, no. Hold it right there while I hit it. Well, I reckon that ought to get it. Been working and working, but I
my sweet honey babe. I'm gonna break this chain off the run. I'm gonna lay down somewhere shady. Lord, I sure am hot in the sun. Hold it right there while I hit. Well, I reckon that ought to get it. Been working and working, working and slaving and working, but I still got so terribly far to go.
Thank you. Tulsa, baby.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1937. 300 policemen waited outside the Bernard Schwartz cigar factory in Detroit, Michigan. They were there to break up the peaceful sit-down strike going on inside the cigar plant. During the winter and spring of 1937, Detroit had seen a wave of sit-down strikes. Some 35,000 workers sat down on the job for better pay and union recognition. Strikers ranged from the women who worked at Woolworth's to the workers at the six General Motors plants. In all, 130 sites experienced a sit-down strike that year. That March, the mayor of Detroit ordered the strikers be forcibly removed. The sheriff asked for 600 special deputies to assist with the brutal crackdown. And so it was today in labor history that under the fictitious claim that an unattended boiler was ready to explode, that the Detroit police burst into the Bernard Schwartz plant. It was later revealed that the assistant boiler operator was actually inside and part of the strike. As police stormed the plant, they were met with fierce resistance from the workers inside. For 15 minutes, the police battled floor by floor with strikers. Many of them were women, armed with wooden cigar molds that they used to attempt to repel the police. In the end, the strikers were overwhelmed. Outside, 40 mounted policemen rode down the 500 picketers that surrounded the building. That day, the police also evicted sit-down strikers at the Newton packing plant and several shoe stores. On March 24th, a rally of 200,000 people in Cadillac Square was held to protest the police tactic. It was there that the UAW's Victor Reuther threatened a two-for-one, two new sit-downs for every one eviction. The sit-down strikes showed the willpower of labor and were a key tactic in union organization in Detroit and across the United States.
Hi, this is Elise Bryant, president of the Coalition of Labor Union Women. On March 24th, 2024, we celebrate our 50th anniversary. In Chicago, Illinois, in 1974, 4,000 women came together, and in the words of Myra Wolfgang, we did not come to swap recipes. As we say in the Coalition of Labor Union Women, a woman's place is in her union. And that is still true today. And we're looking to build women into leadership roles and to be better members and active members in their unions, because unions make a difference for women. So join us as we celebrate 50 years of women in unions and rights. The founding members of the Coalition of Labor Union Women, Mary Ann Medina and Carol Rosenblatt, are here to tell you what it was like on that momentous day in 1974.
My name is Mary Ann Medina, and I'm one of the founding members of CLU. Been around 50 years, so I'm really happy that I'm still here.
I'm Carol Rosenblatt. I'm a CLU member, and I had been the executive director of National CLU from 2000 to 2020.
At that initial convention, what was the atmosphere like?
It was remarkable. I had been living in Philadelphia and active in my union, and was involved in attending some of the kind of pre-CLU meetings, and you know, there were all kinds of young women, which I considered myself then, involved. So many of us decided, you know, that it was really a conference then. We had no idea what to expect, but we knew that this was kind of a time of many of the liberation struggles for women, for African Americans, and it was really time to be addressing the issues that we thought were important within our unions. When we arrived, there were women from every union imaginable, and one of the aspects of CLU that has always been really important to me was its diversity, and particularly at that time, the diversity was so profound, and the women that spoke to us also represented all kinds of industries and people that were under various collective bargaining agreements, but they were all so powerful and inspiring, and there were all kinds of opportunities to meet a lot of young women from all over the country that were involved in all kinds of struggles that I supported. And CLU wasn't just dealing with labor, you know, the narrow labor issues. It really was also a social justice movement, in my opinion. The sisters viewed what we were there for in a very broad way, and we felt we were going to change the world. It was a wonderful feeling.
We'll be right back.
key to unity of all people is in the dream that you had so long ago that lives in all of the hearts of people. Dream become a reality. I know we will, because our hearts tell us so.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the Labor Heritage Power Hour.
If you've got suggestions for guests or topics for future shows, drop us a note at info@laborheritage.org. Our music today included Work Song from Nina Simone, Working Girl Blues from the Rose City Kings, and Union Woman by Lynn Marie Smith. The Labor Heritage Power Hour is a proud founding member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. LaborRadioNetwork.org.
Today's show was produced by me, Chris Garlock, and engineered by Mike Nasella and Kalia Chapman here on WPFW 89.3 FM, your station for jazz and justice, revolutionary radio for revolutionary times.
Thanks so much for listening to the Labor Heritage Power Hour.
The art and soul of the American labor movement. To improve our country.
From WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Thursday, March 21st. Here are some headlines. The Justice Department and 16 state and district attorneys general filed a landmark lawsuit against Apple today, saying that the iPhone maker has a monopoly over the phone market that harmed consumers, developers, and rival companies. Prosecutors say Apple's ecosystem, from the Apple Watch to Apple Pay, supports that monopoly. The lawsuit, however, takes direct aim at the iPhone, Apple's most popular device and most powerful business, and attacks the way the company has turned the billions of smartphones it has sold since 2007 into the centerpiece of its empire. The suit, filed in New Jersey federal court, marks the culmination of a five-year probe into the world's second most valuable technology company. Apple has vowed to vigorously fight the lawsuit and denies the claims. In other news, Fulton County Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee yesterday granted permission for former President Donald Trump and seven co-defendants to appeal his recent decision to allow District Attorney Fani Willis to continue to prosecute Trump's election interference case. Last week, McAfee found Willis could stay on as long as a prosecutor she had a romantic relationship with resigned from the case. Nathan Wade resigned within hours of that decision. After yesterday's ruling, Trump's lawyers said they intend to take the ruling to the Georgia Court of Appeals. McAfee said the case against Trump and his co-defendants will continue while they appeal. A fourth former Mississippi sheriff's deputy was sentenced yesterday to 40 years in federal prison for his part in the racist torture of two black men by a group of white officers who called themselves the Goon Squad. Christian Dedman is one of six officers convicted over the January 2023 assault, during which the two victims were beaten, shot with stun guns, and sexually assaulted. Three other former officers were sentenced earlier this week, and Dedman has received the longest sentencing so far. Federal prosecutors said Dedman was, quote, the most sexually perverted, close quote, of the officers and the most egregious offender. Two more squad members are expected to receive sentences today. And in news from Gaza, satellite images analyzed by the United Nations Satellite Center show that 35% of the Gaza Strip's buildings have been destroyed or damaged since the start of Israel's offensive. In its assessment, the United Nations Satellite Center, known as UNOSAT, used high-resolution satellite images collected on February 29th and compared them with images taken before and after the war broke out. UNOSAT said this represents an increase of nearly 20,000 damaged structures compared to its previous assessment, which was based on images taken in January. UNOSAT will continue to closely monitor